Adrinch's comrade Harry Walters is going to speak just a moment on Darwin Wallace and the theory of natural selection and the misrepresentation thereof, which is social Darwinism. Comrade Walters.
Thank you. Well, you'll recall, of course, that in a previous talk, we were able to consider the succession of life in geological time, and we also considered the emergence of the primates and of also of man. So what we're going to consider today is the machinery of natural selection. Now, natural selection, if I can tell you first of all what it is, the idea of natural selection is this. All living things show a tendency to vary, and heritable variations, each of which may originate from one or more mutations, are transmitted from one generation to another. Those individuals affected by heritable variations which give them a definite advantage over their fellows will be more likely to survive in the struggle for existence and to reproduce their kind. The less favoured individuals, on the other hand, will tend to die out. Thus, in the course of time, of many generations, the species will tend to show a gradual change in the direction of a more perfect adaptation to the environment in which it exists. Now, most textbooks have got a kind of formula written for five propositions. They vary in terminology, but they mean about the same. So I'll tell you what those are so that you'll perhaps get a clearer picture of what natural selection means. The five propositions are these. Reproduction. Like begets like. Reproduction in populations of organisms produces descendant populations of similar organisms. Excess. The reproductive potential of the parent population always greatly exceeds the actual number of its descendants. Variation. Members of a population always vary, and much of this variation is transmitted to the descendants. It becomes heritable. And novelties, that is, mutations may appear. Environmental selection. The space and resources of the environment are limited, so that there is competition within and between populations. Individuals possessing favourable characteristics of whatever sort will tend to compete successfully and leave more descendants than other less favourably endowed individuals. And divergence, the environment varies with time and from place to place. Heritable variations which suit a particular environment will be selected there, and so populations will diverge and differentiate as they become suited to life in different conditions. Now, that briefly is the theory of natural selection. And it's because of this machinery that we were able to consider the development of organisms from simple cell organisms right up to man. The main steps in Darwin's proof, because this was Darwin's theory, the main steps in Darwin's proof of the fact of evolution were established in 1842. And he committed them to paper in a form of a sketch. And then he expanded this into an essay in 1844. Neither was published. And at the same time, or about the same time, Alfred Russel Wallace, another naturalist, came to the same conclusions independently. And he wrote this up around about 1855. Now, although Darwin already knew in 1837 that evolution was an inescapable conclusion to be drawn from the evidence, he did not allow himself to proceed any further with his discovery until he had found an explanation of the fact of adaptation. And he asked himself the question, got to remember also that Darwin was, as well as being a scientist, was also religious. But he asked himself these questions. How could selection operate on wild plants and animals in nature since the beginning of time without man or a conscious being to direct it? And the solution had already occurred to Darwin before he read Malthus's essay on population. And after he had read it, he realised, or he thought, that this was the answer. This was the formula, as it were, which he was looking for. Now, I won't go into a great discourse upon Malthus. Rather, I'd like to read you an extract from a footnote to page 616 of Capital, Volume 1, by Marx. Before I do so, I think it would be much better if, first of all, I read the main text, and then you will understand the nature of the footnote, and I think that in doing this, you'll be able to assess much better the kind of person that Malthus was and the background of his ideas, rather than me trying to do it, without that. So let me read you what Marx says. Marx here is considering what Sir Frederick Moreton Eden was saying in a book that he published, The State of the Poor and History of the Labouring Classes in England from the Conquest to the Present. And he says this: Sir F.M. Eden, in his State of the Poor, A History of the Labouring Classes in England, says, and I quote, "The natural produce of our soil is certainly not fully adequate to our subsistence. We can neither be clothed, lodged, nor fed, but in consequence of some previous labour. A portion at least of the society must be indefatigably employed. There are others who, though they neither toil nor spin, can yet command the produce of industry, but who owe their exemption from labour solely to civilization and order. They are peculiarly the characters of civil institutions, which have recognized that individuals may acquire property by various other means besides the exertion of labour. Persons of independent fortune owe their superior advantage by no means to any superior abilities of their own, but almost entirely to the industry of others. It is not the possession of land or of money, but the command of labour which distinguishes the opulent from the labouring part of the community. This would give the people of property sufficient, but by no means too much, influence and authority over those who work for them, and it would place such labourers not in an abject or servile condition, but in such a state of easy and liberal dependence as all who know human nature and its history will allow to be necessary for their own comfort." And Marx goes on, "Sir F.M. Eden, it may be remarked in passing, is the only disciple of Adam Smith during the 18th century that produced any work of importance." Now, I want you now to read the footnote to the above. And this, of course, introduces our friend Malthus. And Marx says in this footnote, "If the reader reminds me of what Malthus, whose essay on population appeared in 1798, I remind him that this work, in its first form, is nothing more than a schoolboyish superficial plagiary of Defoe, Sir James Stewart, Townsend, Franklin, Wallace and Co., and does not contain a single sentence thought out by himself. The great sensation this pamphlet caused was due solely to party interest. The French Revolution had found passionate defenders in the United Kingdom. The principle of population, slowly worked out in the 18th century, and then in the midst of a great social crisis proclaimed with drums and trumpets as the infallible antidote to the teachings of Condorcet and Co., was greeted with jubilance by the English oligarchy as the great destroyer of all hankerings after human development. Malthus, hugely astonished at his success, gave himself to stuffing into his book materials superficially compiled and adding to it new matter not discovered but by annexed by him. Note further, although Malthus was a parson of the English state church, he had taken the monastic vow of celibacy. One of the conditions of holding a fellowship in Protestant Cambridge University. This circumstance favourably distinguishes Malthus from the other Protestant parsons who have shuffled off the command enjoining celibacy of the priesthood and have taken be fruitful and multiply as their special biblical mission to such a degree that they generally contribute to the increase of population to a really unbecoming extent, whilst they preach at the same time to the labourers the principle of population. It is characteristic that the economic fall of man, the Adam's apple, the urgent appetite, the checks which tend to blunt the shafts of capital, of Cupid rather, as Parson Townshead waggishly puts it, that this delicate question was and is monopolised by the reverence of Protestant theology, or rather, of the Protestant Church, with the exception of the Venetian monk, Ortiz, an original and clever writer, most of the population theory teachers are Protestant parsons. Now, this factor of Darwin taking notice of Malthus's essay on population was a rather peculiar phenomenon, because what it really means is that Malthus' theory of population, which later on became the basis of social Darwinism, which I'll deal with later on, helped to lay the basis of the theory of natural selection. Sometime before the Darwinian theory was declared and even came into existence. So what we had was social Darwinism, as it were, before Darwinism. And I would say, from my own particular personal judgment of having read Darwin's Descent of Man, that Darwin was also a social Darwinist. And that's something which I would have brought out in during the Easter conference had I have been given the opportunity to present my white paper on it, as it were. However, the facts are that in 1831, Darwin, who was only aged 22 at the time, fresh from Cambridge, he was offered the post of naturalist on board HMS Beagle. It seemed to be the custom in those times to offer various people. As a matter of fact, quite a number of prominent men of science were able to get quite a lot of information by being appointed as naturalists to adventures which were sponsored by the Navy. And of course, you'll remember that our old friend Captain Bligh was also one of these who went out after breadfruit to find cheap food for the American slaves. So that Darwin was offered this job and he took it. It was a 10-gun brig, and it was sent by the Admiralty on a surveying voyage round the world. The voyage lasted 5 years, during which time the Beagle visited Brazil, Argentina, Terra del Fuego, Chile, Peru, the Galapagos Islands off the coast of South America in the Pacific Ocean, and a similar kind of group of islands, the Cape Verde Islands, off the coast of West Africa in the North Atlantic Ocean. Tahiti, New Zealand, Australia and other countries and islands on the way. Needless to say, the captain of the Beagle, Robert Fitzroy, was a similar type to some of these other captains. He was a man with immovable biblical beliefs. And you can imagine what his attitude was. However, that didn't deter Darwin, because Darwin was able to amass quite a lot of very, very useful information from the observations that he made whilst he was on that that voyage. Now, Darwin's shorter work on evolution was The Origin of Species. This was published in 1859. This is an explanation of descent with modification, which results in the appearance of new species. And it was Darwin who laid the foundation of evolutionary theory and showed us where to seek the evidence for evolution. Nevertheless, Darwin was not the first. As a matter of fact, one of the first, or the first, was Lamarck. To give him his complete title, Jean-Baptiste Pierre Antoine de Monnet Chevalier de Marc.
What?
He was a French naturalist who was the first to publish a reasoned theory of evolution, or transformation, as it was then called. In his Philosophy of Zoology, that's if I have interpreted the French correctly, of 1809, Lamarck set out his ideas, but he is rather unfortunate to be remembered chiefly in connection with the inheritance of acquired characters. But nevertheless, in France, he's regarded as the father of evolution. Yet, he died in poverty, and he was vilified by the scientific establishment, or the so-called scientific establishment of his time, especially by Baron Cuvier, the greatest authority at that time in zoology, who was a great believer in the crackpot theory that the history of life consists of repeated creations and catastrophic extinctions. However, again, Darwin, who was also very, very contemptuous of Lamarck, was himself, to some extent, a Lamarckian, because he also upheld, from a different point of view, the inheritance of acquired characters. Now, although Darwin laid the foundation of natural selection, he was not aware of quite a number of things. He wasn't aware of genetics. And the primary area where our understanding of evolution transcends Darwin's is in genetics. We now understand the principles, if not all the details, of heredity, and molecular genetics is undoubtedly the single greatest achievement of the life sciences in this century, or in our century. Now, since modern genetics derives from the work of the Austrian monk Gregor Mendel, who lived between 1822 and 1884, Darwin could have benefited quite sufficiently from that. But the importance of Mendel's observations were not realised until both he and Darwin were dead. And it's a popular misconception that Mendel's paper on plant hybridism remained completely unknown until 1900. In fact, there are various instances. In fact, there are 8 references to Mendel's work between 1866 and 1900. But it made no impact on the scientific community because Mendel's theories seemed to be at odds with general observations of inheritance. And those who read Mendel's paper thought his instances of particulate inheritance were exceptions to the general rule. And it was only at the turn of the century that the significance of Mendel's theories was recognised. Now, the particulate theory of inheritance which Mendelian genetics has established involves a number of consequences of fundamental importance for the problem of evolution. In the first place, it substituted for a vague and baseless notion of blending inheritance a science which was quantitative and deterministic, and completely disposes of the difficulty which Darwin laboured to account for the necessary supply of variation on which natural selection could act. The most characteristic feature of the Mendelian gene is that it never blends, but retains its identity and properties intact for long periods of time. And the only thing that happens, of course, is that periodically it mutates. And this means that the amount of variation or variance present in a population resulting from previous mutations is not only conserved through generation after generation, but is actually increased as a result of the recombinations of the gene complexes in their innumerable permutations. And this power of increase is one of the most important results of the biparental method of reproduction, and is the reason why organisms possessed of this mechanism have evolved further than those that lack it. You'll remember in a previous talk that I gave, when we were dealing with the succession of life through geological time, I pointed out to you that there was a period which for quite a long time was considered to be without life. Recent discoveries have shown that there are microorganisms which have been identified as two kinds of cell. The one, the prokaryote cell, is a cell which which continues to increase by simple division, and the eukaryote cell is the cell that contains chromosome mechanisms and consequently is the mechanism which has determined the progression of life to higher and higher organisms. Now, by the time Mendel's work was appreciated, or properly appreciated, in 1900, people that were microscopists, had a good idea of the events taking place in two kinds of cellular division. Now, there are two kinds of cellular division, and as far as genetics are concerned, it's very important to know the difference. Mitosis, M-I-T-O-S-I-S, is a process of simple cell division. The cell completely divides into two cells. And there is another process, meiosis, or meiosis. In meiosis, certain strands in the cell nucleus, called chromosomes, can be seen to divide, and each daughter cell receives a full complement. Mitosis is the ordinary type of cell division, but the sex cells undergo a more complicated process of division, called meiosis. And this leads to the formation of gametes. A gamete is a germ cell. That is, it's either egg or sperm. In the case of human beings, you know, the egg is the ovum, the sperm from the male. It involves two separate divisions of the nucleus, but only one duplication of the chromosomes. The result being, of course, that there are four daughter nuclei, each possessing only half as many chromosomes as the parent cell. During reproduction, each parent contributes one gamete, so that when the egg and sperm unite, the product is a fertilized egg with a full set of chromosomes. Now, to summarize that, and this takes place in all of those plants and animals that have a biparental sex mechanism, ordinary cells, that is, ordinary somatic body cells, have two sets of chromosomes symbolized as 2N. Individuals containing 2N chromosomes are called diploid, But the reproductive cells, pollen and egg cell, and in the case of animals, including man, spermatozoon and ovum, normally contain only one set, N, which is called the haploid, or half number. And fertilization brings together one set from the male and one from the female. Thus, the fertilized egg cell has a double set, symbolized as N plus N. Now, if you'll pass that around, I've got a diagram here, and this will give you some idea of how this operates. In 1909, the Danish biologist Wilhelm Johansson called the individual Mendelian unit of heredity a gene, and experimental work by the American geneticist Thomas Hunt Morgan, not to be confused, by the way, with Lewis Henry Morgan of Ancient Society fame, he and others established at about the same time that genes are located on the chromosomes, and Morgan's experiments were performed principally on the American fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster. And these experiments, as a matter of fact, are still going on, and they are able to provide a hell of a lot of new genetic information. Now, each species of plant or animal has a characteristic number of chromosomes in its cell. Melanogaster has 8. Human beings have 46. That is 23 pairs. Each chromosome has its sister chromosome, opposite which it lines up during cell division. The nucleus of each somatic cell or body cell thus contains 2 complementary sets of genes, whereas a germ cell or a gamete contains only a single set, such as 1 member of each pair of chromosomes. And the significance of this is in relation to Mendel's theories is obvious, because each member of a pair of homologous chromosomes carries a string of genes coding for the same character. Just as each chromosome has a sister chromosome, each gene has what might be called a sister gene. And these 2 genes are not necessarily identical. They control the same character, but they may produce entirely different effects on that character. Of each pair of genes, 1 came from each parent. So an offspring may inherit an identical gene from each parent. It is then said to be homozygous for that gene. That means, you know, it is 2 different ones from each parent. If each parent contributes, homozygous, yes, that means that they're the same. If each parent contributes a different corresponding gene, the offspring is heterozygous. And these terms refer to the genotypes only, because dominance masks the phenotypic expression of heterozygosity. Now, let me explain what that bit of jargon is.
Please do.
This bit of jargon means quite simply this, that each one of us here, each one of us that are the phenotypes of genetic inheritance, have certain characteristics which distinguish each one as an individual. You're short, you're tall, you have blue eyes, you have brown eyes, you have fair hair, dark skin, light skin. Right? Now that's the phenotype. That can be seen and assessed and calculated. The genotype is the factor that is part of your genetic makeup, which cannot be separated or analyzed. So in order to give you an idea of what that means, I've made a diagram. And if you send that round, you'll see what is made. Well, no, the fact is, you see, that the genotypes are the sum total of genetic inheritance. Now, you have got germ cells, and I've got germ cells, and those germ cells carry what you've inherited. And they can't be assessed. I mean, you can't determine, scientists can't even determine by looking at the genes through microscopes that there is a gene there for tall, for being tall or small or fair hair or color blindness or anything like that. This is unknown. But you see, you can carry a gene which is recessive without it having any effect on you, and so could I. And these effects, which will be new phenotypes, will only make themselves apparent in the offspring.
An inherently programmed.
Pardon?
An inherently programmed.
Inherently programmed. Well, I mean, I don't know exactly what you mean by that, but I'll give you a time. You can have time in question time to put that point of view, and I'll answer it. Now, whilst you're considering this bit of jargon and you're looking at this chart, I want to point out that these concepts are also very important in understanding sex, because for the sex of an individual, it's genetically determined, and it's determined at fertilization. Men and women have 22 pairs of chromosomes in common, but the chromosomes of the 23rd pair, called the sex chromosomes, are different for the sexes. With women, have two X's. Women have two X chromosomes, X plus X, whereas men have one X and one Y chromosome, XY. So that human egg cells with 23 chromosomes all contain an X chromosome, whereas sperm cells contain either an X or a Y. And you'll see at once, or you should be able to see at once, that the sex of the offspring is determined by the kind of sperm, X or Y, that fertilizes the ovum. So that if it's a Y chromosome in the sperm that fertilizes the ovum, you have an XY. If it's the X chromosome from the male, it links up with the other X chromosome of the female. And that is the way that sex is determined. Now, genetic variation occurs through the random reshuffling of chromosomes combined with the exchange of corresponding portions of chromosome pairs. And during meiosis, through a process called crossing over. And this considerably increases variation in the offspring. And the end result of these processes is that the offspring receives some combination of genes possessed by its parents. Occasionally, there is a mutation, and an entirely novel gene is produced. And of course, ultimately, this mutations, as they're called, are the fuel of evolution. And this is what I tried to draw your attention to when we were talking about the succession of life through geological time, that the changes brought about by mutations in the genetic structure, those mutations that were adaptive and were, as it were, suitable to the organism, were those that were favoured by natural selection, and consequently, the survival factor was a case of much better adaptation on this basis to the environment. That determined that certain species died out and other species continued, or other species remained in their ecological niche and didn't evolve. The random events of mutations, as a matter of fact, can be modified by radiation and by certain chemicals, but this is something which has developed recently. Now, most mutations are deleterious, they're harmful. They lead to diminished fitness among the offspring and are mostly weeded out by natural selection. Sometimes there's a beneficial mutation, and the individuals that are carrying this mutation acquire enhanced fitness, and new species are formed by the gradual accumulation of changed genotypes. Now, you have been looking at that chart. A changed genotype, obviously, is a genotype that you've inherited, and you've probably, or anybody could inherit, and that gene could have been a mutant gene, which will give you certain characteristics. Not in our particular case, because, as I will point out later on, in my view, of course, natural selection doesn't proceed anymore. It's finished. However, this is the mechanism that ensues, and this is the way in which new species are formed. It's a question of a combination of genetic variation and natural selection through chance and necessity, as one scientist has termed it. Now, this statement of Darwinian theory is a modern statement, and we can be even more specific because Mendelian genetics has been transformed by molecular genetics. And we now understand, or at least those people that are in that business, understand the molecular basis of many of the biological processes which have been described. Now, the discovery of the chemical basis of the genes was made in 1953 by James Watson and Francis Crick. They elucidated the chemical structure of the genetic material, deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. Now, I don't intend to try, even if I were capable of going into any great detail about this particular process. But I'll just give you what are the sort of short academic assessment of what this process is. Now, the DNA molecule consists of a double backbone of alternating sugar and phosphate units. You've heard about the double helix. There's been quite a number of discussions and lectures on the radio which have dealt with the double helix. To each sugar unit is attached a base of chemicals, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. The bases pair with those on the opposite backbone. Adenine always pairs with thymine, and guanine always with cytosine. The long molecule is twisted to form a double helix. When the chromosomes replicate during cell division, the molecule unzips and new bases are added by pairing, so that two new molecules are formed identical to the original one. This is how genes are passed on to successive generations. The genetic message of the DNA is contained in the sequence of the bases. Three bases taken together code for an amino acid, and an amino acid is the building block of proteins, as most of you know anything about biology will know. Thus, the string of bases is translated into a string of amino acids, that is, a protein. Occasionally, there is a mistake during the replication of DNA, and one base is substituted for another. A base is lost, or one is added. And these mistakes are known as mutations. This is something, of course, that Darwin knew nothing about, but it substantiates, beyond any shadow of a doubt, the theory of modification by natural selection and the way in which some characteristics are preserved and others are eliminated. Now, this is all I intend to say about genetics, except to point out that it is largely on the basis of the erroneous application of this science that the new social Darwinists were able to make such an important impact quite recently. And I refer, of course, to the ethologist Lorenz, Ardrey and Morris, who I don't doubt most of you have read something of. But before I talk about these, I thought I ought to say something about the old social Darwinists. Now, natural selection is a process of adaptation in response to the environment or changes in the environment. It's a very slow process. It's a slow process of modification over a great number of generations, so that an entire species could change and form a new species. And this process is not characterized by a savage struggle for survival between members of the same species. Conflict is not involved in such a struggle for survival. It is a struggle for existence, as Darwin termed it, only in the sense that every organism strives to maintain itself, and it does so willy-nilly in relation to other organisms. Darwin himself stated that he used the term in a large and metaphorical sense, including dependence of one being on another, something that other people have called symbiosis, or that Peter Kropotkin, in his book Mutual Aid, called this process mutual aid. And this includes, which is much more important, not only the life of the individual, but success in leaving progeny. In other words, success in leaving other organisms to carry on the process. Although the mechanism of natural selection takes place on the basis of an individual organism, the end result of survival must be on a species basis, so that what occurs is this, that you have a survival factor which is affected on individual members of a species, but the ability to procreate to advantage, to possibly adapt to the environment in relation to food and so on, enables these factors to be passed on to the offspring, and by that process, with a gradual addition of other factors, a completely new species evolves. However, because of some of Darwin's most devoted followers, and foremost amongst these was Thomas Henry Huxley, who I don't doubt you've heard all about, or something about, Darwin's theories were misstated and misrepresented. It was Herbert Spencer who applied to sociology the concept of survival of the fittest. These misrepresentations were seized upon by the supporters of capitalism and by slavery, Negro slavery, to justify exploitation. All of the ruling class seized upon these ideas to justify what they were doing. They were used, for example, to defend Nietzsche's, you know, that the German philosopher Nietzsche's doctrine of the Superman, with whom this idea of survival of the fittest was equated. And before that, between 1853 and 1855, there was and this was before the publication of Darwin's Origin of the Species in 1859, Count Joseph Arthur de Gobineau published a book entitled An Essay on the Inequality of the Human Races, in which he attempted to proletarianize the working class on the basis of their alleged biological inferiority. And this was on a class basis. In other words, apparently, according to this doctrine, all members of the working class were members of the working class because they were inferior biologically. Now, all this nonsense was given new validity with the advent of social Darwinism, and was later used by a very, very peculiar kind of Englishman, peculiar because during that period you didn't as a rule have Englishmen becoming foreigners, as it were. But Houston Stuart Chamberlain and his father-in-law Wagner, the German musical composer, used these ideas to justify the false concept of German racial superiority. Houston Stuart Chamberlain married Wagner's daughter Eva on two occasions, apparently. Not satisfied with one, he had another go. Anyway, this was also used to justify the false concept of German racial superiority. And again, these same ideas were used by Hitler and the Nazis, who this time used them to proletarianize large groups of people on an ethnological and religious basis. So that you can see that these kind of erroneous ideas are used by all kinds of people that want to justify their position of superiority and so on. Now, the ideas of the new social Darwinists are really a rehash of the old. They're the idea of nature red in tooth and claw. They use erroneous, unscientific methods to justify them. For example, and this is what Ardrey does in particular, if you've read any of Ardrey's works, the I can't think of it at the moment, but Territorial Imperative, yes, and so on. If you've read these, you will find that what he does, first of all, is to take the behaviour of man in capitalist society as being natural and then plant it on our animal ancestors, which of course is a libel and a slander upon our animal ancestors. He implants it as innate or instinctual. And then, with a bit of adept logic chopping, he then claims that this alleged instinct for aggression and territoriality, which we are supposed to inherit from our animal ancestors. So you see how the process is carried out. Now, time, I think, doesn't permit me to say very much more about the new social Darwinists. As some of you know, I've gone into much greater detail in relation to them elsewhere in previous talks, except to emphasize that human behavior is learned behavior and not determined by instinct. Completely erroneous. As a matter of fact, as organisms became more complicated and as they became directed more towards the emergence of the human species, instinct fell into the background until it was completely non-existent. Secondly, the alleged aggressive behavior of our primate cousins, that is the modern anthropoid apes, who have descended like us from a common progenitor way back in the Miocene period, and I've already explained this in a previous talk, of an unspecialized kind of ape. This is a figment, again, of their imagination. And this has been amply and scientifically demonstrated and shown by such people as George B. Schaller, who has made a study of the mountain gorilla, and Jane Van Loyck Goodall, and others who have made various studies. In the case of Jane Goodall, it's with chimpanzees. In the Shadow of Man, I would recommend anybody to get that who is interested. It's a very, very good description of the behavior of chimpanzees in the wild. So, to sum up on what I've said, mankind is the end result of about 3,000 million years of recurring mutation and natural selection. And I say the end result advisedly, because although mankind cannot be separated from its lower animal ancestors, as the geneticist Rona Hirst says, and I'll read what she says, if I can find it. And this was written many years ago. It was written before the war, as a matter of fact. She says this. Several, and she's talking about man, of course, the way that man developed and so on. Several fortunate possessions enabled him to gain an ascendancy over all the other creatures. First and foremost was the enlargement of the brain, coupled with his distinctive powers of vision and correlated with the thumb-finger ability to hold and to use other objects. By his greater powers for thought, for memory of the past, and forethought for the future, he was able to outwit the other animals, and as this power gradually evolved to greater heights, he was able to take other forms of life for his own use by the domestication of animals and plants. More and more has he come into the control of his environment, and today we see him mastering one force of nature after another, until the whole resources of the planet come under his control. Not content with this, his roving mind stretches out to the other planets and to the remotest recesses of the universe. Now, how much more is that the case after many years? Because remembering that that was written before the last war, and it's much more apposite at the present time, I would say. In other words, natural selection is the end result of about 300 million years of recurring mutation and natural selection, as I pointed out. And natural selection, in my view, is now at an end. Now, what I mean by that is not that genes will not continue to mutate, but the need or the possibility of natural adaptation will not be there. It's not necessary anymore. Mankind has done in a few years what it took millions of years of other animals to even make any approach to it. You see, selection is now unnatural or artificial. It's not natural and fortuitous anymore. Artificial adaptation is in the hands of human society. And human society, in my view, and in, of course, I hope the view of everybody in this room, is to introduce a new social system, we call it socialism, in order to ensure human survival and the continuation of cultural evolution. I'm not saying that we are socialist merely because of that. I'm only saying that that is the effect that it will have. When socialism comes into being, that's what it will achieve apart from anything else. Now, cultural evolution is the only kind of evolution which is now possible. And this will not be an automatic process, because socialism is the answer. It doesn't necessarily follow that it's going to come about. And I've stressed this on various occasions before. Any more than because organic matter and life is inherent in the inorganic properties of the matter of the universe, that it necessarily exists in parts of the universe other than their own, doesn't follow. Socialism will only be achieved not by human society, but by a particular section of human society, the working class, for the benefit of all humanity. Now, that, to me, is the significance, and that is only a very, very short explanation of the way that natural selection works. But that, to me, is the significance of natural selection. Evolution has no significance whatsoever unless there is a development towards something on a much higher plane. There is no evidence at all over millions of years recently that there any new genera has been has evolved. All that's evolved are a number of new species of ducks, and of course they're all ducks or geese, and they're all geese. There has been no real evolutionary march on. The only march on in evolution has been achieved by human society. And of course, these other animals, some of whom have been in their ecological niche, for example, the bees and the ants have been fixed in their ecological niche for about 30 million years. So you can see that there's going to be no more evolution. Neither, in my view, are we going to get any help from people outside. We're not going to have some marvellous kind of intellectual being arriving on the planet from outer space to help us out of our problems. We've got to do it ourselves. So with that, I'll pack up and allow you to ask questions.